Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you might be. This is Gary Staubel back with you for day two of Get Searches Now. And we will be covering new ground this morning, talking about strategic alliances, talking about getting other people to act as your sales force, getting other people involved in bringing you search leads so that you're not having to generate all of this yourself. And we'll also look at email marketing messages, a couple of examples of that, and talk about sales call reluctance, how to overcome that. And lastly, we'll look at a marketing letter together as well, which is another option. So yesterday was really about language. It was about how to say what you need to say in order to persuade, in order to feel a sense of ease and confidence when you are making your pitch. And that's one of the takeaways yesterday that I hope you got, was that the words themselves don't hold any magic necessarily, but it's really the comfort, the ease, the confidence, the belief that you have in the message that really makes the difference, right? So it's the study I referenced yesterday talking about the fact that behavioral scientists could predict the outcome of telephone sales calls with 87% accuracy without listening to a single word of content. And the takeaway there is that there is this subtext going on, this communication going on that really has to do with body language, voice inflection, breathing patterns, your sense of ease and comfort that gets transmitted over the phone in micro expressions, right? Which have to do with all the things we just talked about, breathing patterns, et cetera. So that was yesterday. Today is going to be a little different. We're going to move on and talk about actual ways to get other people involved in your sales process to make it easier for you. So let me pull up our slide as we're going through here. Once again, you definitely want to have the outline in front of you and make sure that you've got that printed out. You also want to have the additional handouts in front of you. So we're going to go over some of the marketing messages that I mentioned, as well as marketing emails, and the report called 9 Strategies for Overcoming Sales Call Reluctance. So let's jump into the first topic for today, and that is to form strategic alliances. This is something that I started using later, maybe midway through my career. It's not something I knew about when I first started in the business. And it's something that has the potential to transform your business in a big way. It might become something that you get a third of your revenue from, a big chunk of revenue from. But what's great about this is that you can have a sales force out there working for you who are not employees. They're not on staff, right? These are just people that have agreed to help you and to bring business to you. And, you know, you don't have to pay them full time. And before I kind of go through the program, how it works and how it's structured, I want to read you an email from someone who took the program, I think it was 2 years ago. So she was in the same place that you're in right now, hearing about this maybe for the first time. And she took it and she ran with it. And here's an email she sent to me a couple weeks afterwards. She said, "Gary, I wanted to provide you with some feedback regarding a tip you had given during one of your seminars late last year. It was to get job orders through referrals and pay those referring individuals a share of the fees. I used this idea and it was a tremendous success for me. Here's how I utilized it. It was a backfill opportunity. I took the candidate I just placed out to lunch and shared the details of our, quote, partnership program. It's a 10% referral fee for a year on all placements made in the organizations that he helps us establish a relationship with. To my surprise, he was excited about the opportunity. As a result, he made a strong introduction for me with a Fortune 200 company, and we made a placement in literally 2 weeks from the date of our lunch appointment. I earned a $19,000 fee. Fee is at 25%. We obtained two more job orders, and I have candidates in finals with the company right now. I wanted to personally thank you for the idea," and then she goes on with some more personal stuff. But the point is, she took this concept of strategic alliances, she introduced it to a candidate that she had placed over lunch. He was excited about it, referred some business to her, And 2 weeks later, she had a placement plus a number of other things in process. So that's the potential power that this can have for you. And I want you to really think of it that way. There's a difference between things that you may have heard of before versus things that you're actually making six figures from, right? So it's kind of like when you say, if I started talking about getting referrals for a new business, part of your mind is going to say, well, I already know about that. I know about asking for referrals. But then the question is, are you getting consistent placements as a result of those referrals? Is it actually doing something in your business that's tangible? And it's kind of like somebody saying, I know about swimming. I've watched videos on swimming. I have heard presentations on swimming, but I've never actually gotten in the water, right? So you want to be careful to make sure that when you think about something like this, that you're actually getting in the water and testing it and seeing the results. So if you're not getting the results from a program like this, then I would really suggest you perk up and listen to the details of this. So let's go through it. First of all, what's in it for them? If somebody's going to be a strategic alliance partner with you, why would they bother? And before I even get there, the definition you can see on the screen, a strategic alliance involves a formal agreement with someone who can refer business to you, right? Pretty straightforward. But the part there that you want to zero in on is a formal agreement. So there's a difference between kind of what I call a limp handshake, which if we take split business in our industry, most split business is set up with a limp handshake, right? There's no signed agreement. There's no details on when you get paid, whether that's, you know, when the offer is, when the check arrives or after the guarantee period. And all of those little details that are left sort of dangling out there are the reason that most people don't feel safe enough to focus on splits with each other. Whereas if you look at something like the real estate industry, that whole industry is based on splits because they sign contracts, right? And you may have heard the term or the phrase, agreements prevent disagreements. And I think that applies not only to preventing the disagreements, but it also mobilizes people, makes people feel that they can invest in that relationship because there's some formality to it. And so that's the distinction here versus just someone who's going to refer you business, supposedly, every once in a while. And also, there's something in it for them, right? What is in it for them? There's a couple of possibilities. And I'll give you three, and then I'll tell you the one that really, I think, makes the difference. You know, a strategic alliance partner is someone who is connected with the same network that you are trying to market to. Right, so they could be that they just work in that industry. They could have a service business that provides services to the industry, or a bunch of other potential partners, which I'll go through with you. But the point is, they are in the same industry that you are. So you could provide them with the ability to add more value-added services to their offering. Right, so maybe they're a management consultant, and now when they go into a company, they can say, we also have a search firm we're partnered with who can help you with your hiring needs. So it may add a little more value to their services. You also could introduce them to your clients. So if it was someone who was a software vendor, and they were going to introduce you to their clients as a search provider, you could do the same thing for them. Right, it could be a reciprocal referral relationship. But the one that I've had the most success with, and the one that I've seen successful for many, many people, is that you're going to actually pay them a commission. Right, so the other two are okay, but I've never seen it get traction, whereas paying a commission does get traction. So that would be my suggestion to you, is that you could actually compensate them. And letter B says possible partners. Essentially, anyone who is not a direct competitor with you, but also is involved in your marketplace, is a potential partner. So let me give you a few categories. You'll want to write these down. Number one, high-level candidates who are well-connected, And I'm going to come back to that. Number two, former clients. Number three, other recruiting firms who are in a different niche. Other recruiting firms who are in a different niche. And when I say different niche, I don't mean different industry. I mean they do IT recruiting and you do accounting, right? Industry vendors. I already mentioned a few of those. Could be software vendors, other types of vendors that are specific to the industry. Management consultants, HR consultants, market research companies, niche associations, even venture capital firms sometimes. Okay, so high-level candidates, former clients, other recruiting firms working a different segment, industry vendors, management consultants, HR consultants, market research companies, niche associations, and VC firms. Of that group, the one that I have seen the best results with and the one that has produced the best results for me is the high-level candidates. And there's a particular breed of high-level candidate that you want to look out for. And that's somebody who is highly skilled and underemployed. And particularly someone who is in a leadership position, and perhaps they are a baby boomer, they are near retirement, but maybe their portfolio didn't do as well as they thought it would because of the stock market issues of the last 15 years. Maybe they thought they'd be retired by now, but they're not quite there. So their marketability in the marketplace has gone down, but they're really well connected and they still want to make some money. That, I think, is the best scenario for this type of relationship. So I would put an asterisk by that. It doesn't have to be somebody near retirement, but if they are, that is a really good scenario. So again, well-connected, know the industry, leadership position, highly skilled, underemployed. That's the best case scenario. And that is from my experience of doing this personally and also from the people I've interviewed for our roundtable program. And if you are doing the membership this month, the free membership of the roundtable program, if you want to hear someone who has really run with this, I'll give you a couple of people to listen to. There is a section in the members area called Big Biller Interviews, and they're interviews with people who have done exceptional things in our business. One of them is a guy named Adam Sloan, S-L-O-N-E. He took this concept, he built a company with about 20 recruiters, very successful company, and this is a big portion of their business, something I taught him 15 or 20 years ago, and he really ran with the concept. And I believe, don't hold me to this, but I believe in one of those interviews he said about a third of their business comes from this type of alliance, and they do a lot of business, very successful. So check him out if you are in the members area. The other one that I would suggest is Alan Carty, C-A-R-T-Y. His example would be an example of someone who took this concept and ran with it with an association. So Alan speaks a lot to the association that he is a part of. He's, I believe, in a leadership position with the association. And for a while he may still have, a alliance, and I forget the details of it. If you listen to the interview, you'll get the details. But an alliance whereby he would promote, purchase a vendor booth at their conventions, and then he would get extra special treatment from the association, get well connected with the people in the association, speak at their meetings. So he really took the concept and applied it to niche associations. So we talked about high-level candidates, why they're so good to do it with, and we talked a little bit about niche associations. There are other people that I know of, other members of the Roundtable program, who have even become the president of the association that they recruit for, which I've known a few people who accomplished that. And I've always found it strange that an association for IT auditors would have a search firm owner as their president. But if you've ever hung out with associations, usually they're starving for leadership. They're starving for people to volunteer and to take part and to spearhead things. So if you're wired that way, where you're a good networker, that could be a really good thing for you. And if you listen to Alan Carty's interview in the roundtable, you'll hear that he hates cold calling. He hates having to drum up business from scratch. And so he built a business where he didn't need to cold call. And he's very good at networking, and he enjoys public speaking. So for him, he was able to leverage that into working with these associations and other relationships he developed as alliances as well. Some others may not have the same. Personally, I'm not a big fan for myself of networking, like showing up at a association meeting and shaking hands and all of that. It's fine, but it's not the easiest or most fun way for me to market myself, right? So that wouldn't be my primary way. When I was working the desk full time, the high level candidate connection was the much more precise for me. And you know, you can just identify the centers of influence in your industry by asking the question, who else sells to my target audience? Who else is selling to my target audience? And I talked a little bit about what's in it for them. And I said it's paying a commission. The commission that I would suggest to you is 5 to 20% of the revenue for a period of 1 year with whatever client they help you to secure. Okay, so 5 to 20% of the revenue over the first year. And what's interesting about that is that it lasts for a year. And by the way, you can make it 2 years if you want to. It's up to you. But if it lasts for 1 year, if they help you get a signed contract today, that's when the 1 year starts. Maybe you make a placement 2 months from now. That commission goes to your alliance partner. But then they have a vested interest in sort of midwifing your relationship over that course of the year, because they will make money on whatever placements happen after that. So it's not like it's just the referral. They have a vested interest in helping you to sustain that relationship for the first year, which is a real nice perk. And this is one of those strategies that has the potential to build steam over time. Because in the beginning, you introduce it to someone, and it's conceptual, right? So you have to really illustrate it and map it out for them with some detail. So, for instance, let's just say, for argument's sake, you're going to pay 10% commission. And let's say your average fee is $30,000. So for them, it's $3,000, right? That's what they would get on an average placement. So if I take my key person out to lunch and I say, hey, I've got this partnership program I wanted to tell you about, see if you may have an interest, I'm going to say, you know, our average fee size is $30,000. 10% commission is $3,000 for you on each placement. If we make three placements over the course of the year, you're looking at about $9,000 in commission, and that's for an investment of maybe an hour of your time, maybe less. So $9,000 for approximately 1 hour of your time. Even if we say 5 hours of your time, that's a pretty darn good rate. And if you help me do that with three companies, that's $27,000 over the course of the year for somewhere between 5 and 15 hours of your time. So you really have to map it out that way. You want to be realistic and give them numbers that make sense, but you need to map it out and illustrate it that way. And who you're going to do this with, preferably, is somebody that you have a relationship with, particularly a candidate you've placed or a candidate you've known over time, a former client who now has got on their own with some type of consulting business, even an HR person who used to be involved in HR, is well connected, and is now working as a consultant. If you take them to lunch, you've got more opportunity to really connect with them, but you don't have to do that, right? You could do it via Zoom or even a phone call. But preferably, you're able to build some trust with them because this will be a relationship if you go forward with it. So those are a couple of the details. 5 to 20% is the commission. It's paid over 1 year, and there's a couple of different categories of people that you might use to contact. The real key thing here is that you actually take action on this idea. If this is something that you're interested in, I would put a calendar item right now, even though I told you yesterday not to double task or multitask. I would at least write a sticky note or something. If anybody's name comes to mind, five people that come to mind, write those down and make a commitment that you're going to at least send off an email asking them if they'd like to discuss this with you. Because this is a potential gold mine for you without a lot of work. And those are the types of opportunities that I'd like to zero in on. So the leverage involved in this one is different than the other things we talked about. Right? You calling people one by one, which is essentially what we were talking about yesterday, doesn't have a ton of leverage over time. Right? What can add more leverage to that, which we may talk about today, is that appointment-driven calendar, right? Having someone else schedule appointments for you that you show up to. So it's not you cold calling people, but it's either you or someone else using email or another method to schedule appointments with potential clients. That's a much more highly leveraged use of your time than just you cold calling. And this is even better because it's other people out there doing it for you. So if you took a full week and said, I'm going to do nothing but introduce this program to anyone who I think might be a potential person, that would be an excellent use of your marketing time because it has the potential to have them out there working for you while you're doing something else. So let's look at a strategic alliance plan. My screen just went dark. Give me one sec here. Okay, so strategic alliance plan, five very easy steps. Number one, identify all the potential alliance partners and centers of influence in your industry. And like I said, if you could think of any now, I would write them out. That's the first step. Number two, determine what's in it for them. So that's going to be the commission most likely, and you have to determine what that commission structure is, how long it lasts, and what the number is. Number three, create a script or key points to cover. So with this, you're not going to have a word-for-word script. This is more of a conversation with someone, hopefully someone you know. But you definitely want your bullet points written out so that you know how you want to frame that conversation. And if you can, take them out to lunch. Or do it via Zoom where you have the visual element. Those would be my suggestions for how to initially introduce it. Number four, create a simple contract. So you don't need something complicated, but you do need something formal that they can sign and you can sign. Because, as I said before, agreements prevent disagreements. And also, it makes it feel more solid. And using that example of splits, when people say, oh, yeah, I do splits and I don't have a signed agreement, if you ask them how many splits they do, the answer is usually zero, right? So because nobody feels like it's very serious if there isn't a signed contract. So just create something simple that you both can sign. And then number five, this is the important part, start calling potential partners and pitching them. Really make that an action step. So there's a saying that I use with my coaching clients all the time, which is top producers make a daily habit of the things that average producers do every so often. Top producers make a daily habit of the things that average producers do every so often. And this class isn't really focused on how to integrate the dailiness of marketing into your week, but that's a really important element. So if you set aside even 30 minutes a day for marketing, and what I call that are actions, marketing actions. So I might want to do five marketing actions per day. right? Could be an email, could be an in-mail, could be a phone call, could be an invitation to set up a lunch. That's fine. But I would integrate this into your marketing time so that this is a primary focus. And actually start calling and having conversations. All right, so that is it for strategic alliances. Let's move on to client referrals. Okay, secure marketing referrals from your clients. So you're probably familiar with the idea of getting referrals for candidates, but the question is, how many referrals do you get for new clients, new business? The idea here is that you can have your current clients refer you to either known openings or just people that they're connected with. And what you want is the hiring authority's name and phone number, right? That's what you're going for. But how you get there is going to require a bit of finesse because you're asking your current clients, which can be delicate, of course. And one of the best ways that I know of is a method that I heard from Barbara Bruno years ago, which is to offer a thank you program. And I love this idea. It's a thank you program for any placement that is made with a referral that came from your client. And the way it works is you will donate $500 or $1,000 to their favorite charity. And so if the client refers you to someone, you're going to donate on their behalf, in their name, to that charity. And it will be a pet charity of that client. Everybody has a pet charity, right? Whether it's autism, breast cancer, whatever it might be, everybody has something that hits home for them, something that they've dealt with, their family members that they care about. And this is an interesting strategy because if you lead off with this, it doesn't come across very well, right? It comes across as a bribe. But remember yesterday I talked about the oh, by the way concept, meaning I've already left the conversation, I'm heading out the door, and I turn around as I'm walking out and I say, oh, by the way, we also have a thank you program if you're able to help us to connect with a new client. And I'll explain how that fits in. So you're not going to lead off with the thank you program. It's going to be an oh, by the way, after the fact. And obviously, you only make that donation if there's a placement that happens as a result. But why would you connect this with your clients? Why would you be asking your clients? The idea is that after you have sold the way that I told you to sell yesterday, which is with the client's best interest in mind, which is authentically putting the client first, not trying to sell them something they don't need, not trying to put pressure on them, but rather trying to see if you can be of service. If that's how your entire process is, that's how the entire search process is when they work with you, you're going to make a good impression on them. They're going to see you as trustworthy. Integrity is hard to manufacture, right? So if it's there, they're going to detect it. This assumes you have a relationship with them. If you're at arm's length or you're stuck in HR, this is more difficult, of course. Doesn't mean you shouldn't ask, but it's more difficult. This assumes you have some type of relationship with your clients. But the idea is that after a placement has happened, that's the easiest time for you to ask for referrals. Your clients have peers working in other companies or former employers or former peers at those other employers that they could refer you to if they wanted to. So you want to be able to ask and see if you can get referrals from them. So you need kind of an outline or an agenda for how to go about that conversation because it could be awkward and it could be tricky, right? And you don't want to blow it. So here's a 7-point agenda for you. You should see that under number 6, letter B, on how you'll handle this conversation. So number 1, it says agenda. That just means that it's actually on your agenda. It's on your plan to give them a call. And you're going to add this to whatever form or template or process you currently use. Hopefully you have a search process checklist or something similar so that you've got a project managed approach to your searches. And wherever on that checklist you're getting close to the end, you've made the placement, you've helped the candidate to get through the resignation, et cetera, and now you're at a point where you're pretty much at the end of the process, make sure you add ask client for referrals to that search process as one of the steps. Okay, so it has to be on your agenda. That's what makes it a system rather than just an idea that you heard about once on a seminar. Number two, if you were referred to the client in some way before, so if you came to them as a result of a referral, then you want to remind them of how you met, because it will reinforce the value of referrals in general, right? So we're at the end of a happy process. They're pleased with the service you gave them. You've made a placement, and you came to them as a result of a referral. You need to remind them of the value of that. So you could ask a value-seeking question, you could remind them how you met, which would sound like this. Susan, we've been working together for about 2 years or so. How did you first hear about me? Right? How did you first hear about me? And if she says, well, I was referred to you by Bob over at ABC Corporation. He had worked with you and said good things about you, and so I was able to connect with you. All you're doing is just reminding her of the value of a referral. And then number three is to ask a value-seeking question. What's been the benefit of working with us? What has been the benefit of working with us? And what you'll find here is that people often don't just talk about the outcome, which is you found us a great person, but they'll talk about you and they'll talk about your service. And they may talk about your integrity or your follow-up or they were able to believe you and you were honest. Those are the kind of things that typically will come up when you ask that question. So you're just trying to reinforce the value that you've provided for them. Okay, so that, again, might sound like what's been the benefit of working with us? And then number four, ask for help and advice. Okay, ask for help and advice. That might sound like this. I'm glad you've gotten value. Can I ask for your help and advice on something? I'm glad you've gotten value. Can I ask for your help and advice on something? I've always liked that phrasing, help and advice, because, again, this is someone who feels good about you, presumably, right now. So it's a good frame to start with. And then number five, this is the most important point of them all, ask for the referral. Okay, who do you know who may appreciate the same type of relationship? Who do you know who may appreciate the same type of relationship? And by the way, I know that trainers like myself always say that you have to say, who do you know? I think that's actually quite gimmicky and silly. It's okay to say, do you know of anyone who may appreciate the same type of relationship? You're not going to play, linguistic jujitsu on someone that traps them into saying yes when they meant to say no anyway, right? So if you feel more comfortable saying, do you know anyone who may appreciate the same type of relationship, feel free to do that. Again, I think the authenticity and the comfort you have is far more important than thinking you're going to mousetrap someone by using a particular phrase. And then number six is important. Help them by getting specific. Okay, help them by getting specific. I believe you know several controllers in the Seattle area. Or I believe you're a member of the Audit Alliance in blah, blah, blah. So remember yesterday when I talked about the perennial follow-up script, the one that works all the time, which is, are there any types of talent you'd like me to keep an eye open for in the next 90 days? I said that tacking on the 90 days gives it a different frame than if I just said, are there any types of talent you'd like me to keep an eye open for? The 90 days helps them to zero in and focus and be able to answer that question in more of a crisp way. And it's the same thing here. If you just say, do you know anyone else who would appreciate the same type of relationship, they might just kind of space out, right? Because maybe they're distracted, maybe they're thinking about something else and nothing's coming to mind. But if you say, I believe you used to work over at Siemens, or I think you came from Oracle originally, I'm just wondering maybe anybody there who might appreciate the same type of relationship. So if you can give them something specific that you know of that relates to their history, it makes it easier for them to help you. And then number 7, from lead to referral, would you mind sending Tom an email before I give him a call? Now, this one's a little tricky. As you know from doing this, what can happen is you get a referral. If you keep it in their court, which is they're supposed to take the next action, right? So let's say Susan is referring you to Tom. If you're on the phone with Susan and she says, Tom is so-and-so and he's great and here's my relationship, and you know, if the next thing that's supposed to happen is that Susan sends an email and maybe CCs you on it, what do you do now if 72 hours goes by and she never sends the email? Or maybe she did send the email, but she forgot to CC you. It gets kind of awkward fast. So depending on how you feel about that, you may just want to run with it yourself. You may not even want to. You may frame it differently and say, do you mind if I CC you when I reach out to Tom and just say, you know, we had a conversation and it motivated me to reach out to him? That way you're in the driver's seat. So it's a judgment call, right? If they're willing to pick up the phone and call, then that's fine. Or three-way call with you on the line or whatever you can work out. But make sure to avoid the trap of their good intentions just kind of falling by the wayside because of distraction or who knows what. And then lastly, you'll see the final one is to describe your thank you program, and it's optional, right? You don't have to do that. So I said before, the sequence really matters, and you know, you've already given me the referral, we've already gone through all this, and now at the end I say, oh, by the way, if I'm able to make a placement with Tom, we do have a thank you program whereby we will donate $1,000 to your favorite charity. So it doesn't have that smarminess to it, because it's been an oh, by the way. And if you can, find out what their favorite charity is and maybe get into a conversation about why that matters to them. You don't have to push for that, but sometimes that'll just happen, and you can allow it to happen by creating space for that. And that's a good thing, by the way, to get them thinking that way. In this program, the same with the Strategic Alliance program, has the ability to really pick up speed once you make one placement. Because going back to the Strategic Alliance program, if it's conceptual, you had lunch, you had this conversation, but it's just conceptual, it's very different when they get a deposit of $3,000 to their account, right? Or a check for $3,000. The minute that happens, they start bugging you. They start coming to you, hey, have you thought about this? Hey, have you contacted this guy? And the more checks they get from you, the more motivated they're going to be to do it. So there's a tipping point that happens once you start having success. It's kind of like somebody said, the trick to money is having some, right? The trick to money is having some money. So the trick to a Strategic Alliance program is making a placement with it. Because once you do, it's going to pick up steam on its own in most cases. And that applies also to the thank you program concept. You donate $1,000 to the Autism Association in their name. You notify them of it. I think Barbara used to create a plaque as well and send it to the client, you know, saying so-and-so has donated $1,000 to blank foundation on this date. Just to really cement in the idea of what actually happened. Once they get a plaque like that, or once they are notified that that has happened, they're going to want to continue. It's a very good feeling for everyone, and it's going to pick up steam on its own. Couple other things to think about that are related to this stage of the process, meaning you've finished your placement, things have gone well, is you might want to also consider asking for letters of recommendation. There's a trainer in our industry, I don't know if he works anymore, his name is Jeff Sprutney. And he, at the time, this is back in the late 90s, I think, when I saw him speak, he was talking about the concept of getting letters of recommendation after every placement or from clients. And at the time, he said that he had 500 letters of recommendation, which meant that if a client or a prospect that he really wanted to work for was not responding to him, he was able to send them one letter of recommendation per week for the next 10 years if he wanted to, and it would be different letters of recommendation. It's an extremely powerful thing to walk into a client's office with a binder and just hand it to them and say, this is letters of recommendation from competitors of yours about our service. Totally different selling proposition than you bragging about how long you've been in business, right? So, again, get really strategic about inserting into your search process these types of final touches at the end of the process. And that could be included in your marketing packet, however you send that out. Oops, we got a little streak there. And then number seven is to entice your candidates to become part of your sales force. Entice your candidates to become part of your sales force. So your candidates have the potential to be your best source of marketing leads. They have the potential because they're out there every day, the ones particularly who are actively looking for a position. If you've got 50 candidates you're working with or you're aware of who are actively looking for positions, that multiplies the amount of eyeballs looking on the web, looking at company websites, getting referrals from their friends. It multiplies it exponentially from what you can do on your own. So if there's a way for you to tap into that information that's already there, it's just not available to you yet, then it can give you a huge competitive boost compared to your competitors who maybe are just looking at Google alerts or company websites or job postings, right, for information. So the first thing, and you're probably doing a version of this now, but just as a reminder, the first thing is to really sell the idea that before they send a resume anywhere, that they contact you first and ask you if you have contacts with that company. A lot of times with these conversations, the devil is in the details, because how you frame it and whether the concept I like and that I talk a lot with my clients is the idea of screwing it down tight, right? So if you're working for me and you say, oh, yeah, I covered timely feedback, and I say, well, what does that mean? I tell them I need timely feedback. Okay, well, what does that actually mean? How did you phrase that? I said, well, we ask for timely feedback, and then I moved on. That's definitely not the same as saying, I want you to be at the very top of my priority list. I want to be able to give you the best level of service that I know we are capable of and that you deserve. In order to do that, my request is that we get a return phone call within 24 hours. Because if we do, we can keep your search moving at full speed. And if we don't, we really have no choice but to put your search aside and prioritize those who are giving us that timely feedback. You see the difference? One is, yeah, I covered that. The other is I screwed it down tight. I made it have some emotional connection, and I made sure that they are bought into it. And the way I do that is by saying, does this sound workable for you? Or what are your thoughts? And then based on how it lands for them, I'll decide whether to move on or not, right? So if they say, yeah, that makes total sense, 24 hours is fine, you know, thanks for letting me know, then I'm going to move on. If they go, yeah, then I'm probably not going to move on. I'm probably going to dig into that a little bit more to see what's going on there because I'm not satisfied with that answer, right? In relation to this, if you hear about something, call me before you send a resume. And the benefit to you is, so that's the key phrase, the benefit to you is, because they're not going to do anything because you want them to do it, right? They're going to only do it because they see a true benefit to them. So the benefit to you is, if you send it on your own, let's say to a company website, a job posting, first of all, you're going to end up on a very large stack in a clerk's office in human resources. That person is not probably technically qualified to evaluate your background. Their job is really, it's kind of like a fisherman who brought in a bunch of, you know, raggedy fish and octopus and all kinds of things. They've got to basically throw all the junk out and keep the ones that are clearly the fish they want. And so they do that with a hatchet, not a scalpel, right? Because they got so many resumes that come in. And I forget the statistic, you can Google it, but it's 80-something percent chance that you will never hear back from human resources if you submit a resume through a company website. Okay, so don't quote me on the exact number, but I believe it's 85% chance that you will not hear back if you submit a resume through a company website. And I'm sure that's Googleable. Contrast that with, if you let me know who they are, chances are I have a relationship with the company because this is the area that I work in. I'm able to be an advocate for your background. I'm not going to submit you through a clerk. I'm going to go directly to the hiring authority, and I'm going to make a case as to why they should prioritize your background. And I'm really going to be your cheerleader, talking about what you've accomplished, what your fine points are, et cetera. So I can advocate for you. And if I don't have any contacts there, or if I'm not successful, I'm going to let you know that within 48 hours, and then you submit on your own. So that is going to land differently than just send me a resume before you, or let me know before you send a resume. Right? So it's really illustrating the emotional impact and then saying, does that sound workable for you? And again, if they say, yeah, that makes sense, I'll do that, then you move on. Okay, so that's one way that you can have them be a part of your helping you to get leads. The other way is to tell them the truth, which is that if they invest time and bring you leads that are good for them, and these would be people who are actively searching, obviously, people who really want to find a new position. But you can say, if you bring me 20 companies or 10 companies that you think you're a good fit for, or just that you really want to work for, and tell me why you think you're a good fit, and preferably give me the name of the person you would report to, I will do the hard work for you. I will do the legwork of tracking them down and make it a formal presentation of your background. You're just going to do the initial detective work to collect the details. So if you think about it, if you were a candidate in the marketplace, you would probably know where you want to work, what companies you're excited about, right? You already know what those companies are, where you think you would be a fit. So why not just collect those and send them to someone who could make a presentation for you? And you're asking them to do a little bit of extra work, which is to provide you with the name of a person they would report to. Now, I don't make that a requirement, but it's just a suggestion. And if you got 10 companies from one candidate, and maybe three of them had the name of the hiring authority, they just saved you 30% of that legwork. That's a big percentage. If you do that every time, you're saving an awful lot of time, right? So they're bringing stuff to you. But again, you've got to sell that to them, why they should bother. The other thing you can do is just pay a referral fee, right? So a referral fee of $500 or $1,000. Out here in Silicon Valley, companies are paying, you know, $7,000 for referrals. They pay high amounts of money for referrals if it's a software engineer in a field that's really highly competitive. So some search firms have said, whatever your company program is, we will match it, or we'll do it plus 1,000. If you're in a really competitive marketplace, you could have a policy like that. So think about whether you would use a referral fee. And sometimes people feel weird about using referral fees. I never really know why they feel weird about it. Everything in our, you know, in our economy works based on incentives. This is just another incentive. So when I was running a full-time search firm, I didn't mind at all paying out split fees, referral fees, strategic alliance fees, because I knew what I was good at. I was good at schmoozing and business development, and I was good at closing deals. And I didn't really like everything in between, right? The stuff in between was like, eh, not that exciting to me. So I'm happy to pay people to generate leads, generate candidates, et cetera, if that speeds up my ability to just close deals. And I would suggest that you have that kind of perspective as well. So that's it for this section. What I want to do just for a few minutes is review some of those worksheets, and we're going to switch to Q&A. We'll wrap up by 10:15 Pacific, and we will either have a full 15 minutes of Q&A, or we'll have whatever. We'll do our best to answer every question, and then we will wrap up. Okay? So in terms of the worksheets, and if you don't have it in front of you, all you have to do is go to the handouts page, and you'll see that there are three or four different worksheets that you can look at. The first one I want to look at briefly is 9 strategies for overcoming sales call reluctance. Okay, 9 strategies for overcoming sales call reluctance. And this I talked a little bit about yesterday. There's a couple things I would say about this right off the bat. First of all, there's nothing to be gained from forcing yourself to eat your vegetables if you just hate the taste of vegetables and you don't want to do it, right? So if there is something like this, whether it's cold calling or warm calling or scheduling appointments that you just don't want to do, and sometimes people have been doing this business for 20, 30 years, and they come to me in coaching and say, I can't get myself excited about making follow-up calls or marketing calls. And to me, I always say to them, I think you're burnt out. It's not mysterious. You've done it for a long time, and you're bored, or you just don't want to have to do it, or you're just rebelling against it. So that's fine. It doesn't matter to me how it gets done. It just matters that it gets accomplished, right? So what does that mean? It means you might pay someone else to do it, first of all. It means you might use technology to make it easier. I mentioned yesterday auto dialers, which I would definitely investigate if you're interested, which makes it a much more efficient process than you individually dialing. Let me just see if I have a name of one to refer you to. Makes it much more efficient than you just doing it yourself. The one that I would, and I'm not endorsing this company, I don't get a commission from them, just to give you an example, there's one called Call Logic, that has had good reviews from multiple sources that I know of. So, and I'm not going to get into how it works, but it's a way to supercharge your dialing potential. And the fatigue and the exhaustion that comes from getting voicemail 80 times a day gets relieved to a large degree, and the efficiency goes up tremendously. You will make 4 times as many calls with less effort by using something like Call Logic. And there's other ones, but that would be one. So that's, you know, when we're talking about sales call reluctance, there are ways to just not have to do it yourself, or make it easier to do, or pay someone else who's going to do it for you, right? But the idea is that if we are talking about call reluctance, there was a study that was done where they looked at email presentations versus those using the phone. And they looked at the ability to persuade. They looked at communicating complex emotions, humor, laughter, cynicism, all these different nuanced emotions. And what they found is that those who were using the phone were 40% better at communicating with those emotions than those who use email. 40% better. So that's a big percentage. You don't want to give up on the telephone when it has that much potential to deepen relationships, give you the ability to leverage your position to have influence. So I'm not going to go through the whole report with you. I just want to help you to keep in mind a couple things. One thing is that if I said to you, if you were feeling a lot of call reluctance, if I said to you, I want you to go home and come back and bring me a jar filled with call reluctance, you would not be able to do that, obviously, right? So what does that mean? It means that call reluctance is a thought pattern. It's a thought pattern that exists between your ears. It's not something that exists in the universe aside from between your ears. So that's the first thing to understand, is this is a thought pattern that I have, right? And if the resistance is to interrupting someone's day and being a pest, that part of it is a good thing. That part of it makes sense. In other words, you are interrupting someone's day, and maybe you are being a pest, right? So if that's what's going on, or if you just never catch anybody on the phone, then I would suggest switching to more of a appointment-driven calendar, an appointment-driven system. And the way that would work is that you use email or in-mail primarily as your opener, and the purpose of whatever email or in-mail you're sending is to then schedule a quick phone appointment. If you want to hear someone who did this very strategically, and I'm only mentioning people that are actually have, you know, okayed, you know, sharing their stories in our program. Another guy's name is Yosef Kolish, C-O-L-I-S-H. That is also in the roundtable members area. He's a coach, was a coaching client of mine for a long time. And we looked at his revenue. He was an above average producer, but he really wanted to hit, you know, exceptional numbers. And we made a few tweaks and changes. One of them was switching to this appointment-driven calendar. And he took that idea and really ran with it, where he had an appointment every 30 minutes. I mean, he was just scheduled all day. That plus some other changes really changed his production. And he, I want to say he doubled it within about a year. May not have been quite double, but almost double, which very rarely happens, by the way. And he did that. One of the changes was moving toward more of an appointment-driven calendar. So he used email to set up phone calls. And that kept him on the phone and productive. And if, again, if you want to hear it, it's Yosef Kolish in the members area. But that's fine. I hope you can see the point is to find a workaround that works for you with regard to this. Don't bang your head against the wall. You can read the report to know a little bit about what the types of call reluctance are, what the causes are, and then some of the solutions as well. All right, let's look at the second report, which is marketing emails, to give you some examples. And a couple things, if you're looking at that, the marketing emails report, you'll see a couple of different things. One is in the introduction on the first page, I said, as I've already mentioned, the objective of effective marketing email is that it leads a prospect to one simple action, usually a phone appointment. Okay, so you got to know what it is that you're asking them to do, that you're wanting them to do, and how it is that they can say yes to that, right? So it should end with some type of brief, easy-to-answer call to action. That's really, really important. The subject line, there's different schools of thought on subject lines. You can see some examples there of what might work for you. And there's two types of emails here. One is a general introduction, and the other is marketing a candidate. That general introduction email, I will tell you, comes from Adam Sloan. He's the one I mentioned earlier, who has done two or three different interviews with us. And he generously agreed to share this. This is a very simple, straightforward message that they use to reach out to people on LinkedIn or via email. And what you'll notice is, first of all, paragraphs are very short, right? Paragraphs are about one sentence each. So in terms of readability, it's really easy to scan, okay? The second sentence is the only part that's really customized. We've been following your company in the news and know you're launching blank and doing blank. So when you're thinking of contacting a company, sometimes the paralysis comes from thinking you have to do all this research about them. In theory, you could cancel out that second sentence if you wanted to, but if you're able to put that in there, it helps. It helps to give it a little bit of bottom end, right? A little gravity, so it looks like you actually know what you're talking about. And then the last sentence, Bob, would it make sense to schedule a quick chat to see if we can be of service? That's what they use mostly, and it generates good results for them. They also have a very specific niche market, and their name is very clearly, it's clear to know what they do from their name. Sometimes if your name is, you know, ABC Associates, you don't get the same as automation techies or, you know, database administrators only, you know, different. So they have the a very specific name that helps as well. And then email number two is marketing a candidate. And that subject line, real quick, turbocharging R&D, it's not something I would personally put or think of putting, but it's something that has been tested. And this is another member of ours who agreed to share it. And that kind of language sometimes is what gets people to open things. Okay, so that's what he uses. And again, you'll notice a very short introductory paragraph followed by bullet points that are really super easy and clear to read, followed by a one-sentence call to action. Susan, would it make sense to set up a quick chat about this candidate? And the reason I like these calls to action is somebody can hit reply and put the word yes, right? That's what you need. Sometimes I see a lot of introductory emails, and either they're too long or the sentences are too dense, or it'll just end with, you know, I hope to talk to you soon or something. Like there's nobody knows what to do next. So just make sure yours is ending with a clear, crisp question that they can say yes to, a clear call to action. And the last document we're going to look at is the VITO letter, V-I-T-O. Stands for Very Important Top Officer. It's a book. If you're interested in the concept, there's a book of the same name that you can check out. This is a system whereby you're actually mailing a letter to someone. Now, you could do it via email as well. The benefit of a letter is, of course, that no one sends letters, right? And if you do send a letter, you want the envelope to be handwritten, okay, which is not very professional. That's probably what, you know, most of us think. And that's exactly why it's going to get opened. So a letter is a physical object. An email is a digital nothing, right? It's very easy to delete an email. A letter, especially with a handwritten envelope, is going to physically end up on someone's desk. And because it's a handwritten envelope, they're probably going to open it. And then now they've got this physical object in their hand. And so it makes a different impression. It's the same with sending a fax, you know. It'd be like sending smoke signals or a telegram. Those are not going to actually, well, yeah, anyway. these actually end up on their desk, right? So it's a different, and the fact that they are so old-fashioned is what makes them, you know, kind of interesting to reuse. But if you look at the structure, again, very short paragraphs. It actually starts with a headline, which is different than you can do it in email. So here's the headline, which will have a statistic tied to it. One of the top law firms in San Francisco reduced their time to hire top attorneys from 63 days to just 29 days as a result of choosing us as a search partner. Would it make sense for us to have a 15-minute conversation to discuss doing the same for your firm? So that is the first thing they read. It's right at the top. It's not, we've been in business for 30 years, we specialize in blank. It is a headline that has a benefit, preferably with a number attached, some statistic, right? And then you'll notice the call to action at the bottom is a little different. I will be calling you on Thursday, February 25th between 10 and 11 to see if we may be of service. If this is not a convenient date, please get back to me and let me know a more suitable time. And you could do this, by the way, through email as well. I'll give you a call tomorrow morning between 10 and 12. That's not a good time. Let me know. What I love about that is it obligates you. It's not so much what they're going to do. It's what you have to do now because you've obligated yourself. So that's what I call a positive constraint, right? You put a positive constraint on yourself to follow through on the behavior that you might otherwise just procrastinate. So those are some examples of things you can take and run with yourself. And we are at about 5 after, so we're obviously going to be wrapping up here fairly quick. Let me just do a quick recap of what we've covered so far today, and then we'll look at, see if we have any questions. So the first thing I talked about was this idea of forming strategic alliances. I told you this could become a big portion of your business, potentially a third of your business or more. The idea is you get this unpaid until they produce Salesforce out there in the world working for you. You're going to pay them between 5 and 20% commission for a period of 1 year. And you're going to really explain in depth how the program works, what the benefits are for them, and paint a picture of how much they could earn. And again, my example of 3 placements in 1 year is $9,000 for 10 hours of work, right? It's a pretty good return. Next, we talked about the idea of securing marketing leads from your clients. I gave you an 8-point agenda for how to do that, how to go through that conversation point by point. And I told you that your thank you program is $500 or $1,000 to their favorite charity. You might even have a plaque made in their name for them to commemorate that. And that the key thing there is that the thank you program is an oh, by the way, right? It's tacked on at the end. And then 7, I talked about enticing your candidates to become part of your sales force. And the idea there is to really paint the picture of what happens if they do submit a resume on their own through human resources, which is you end up on a giant stack in a clerk's office, or if they call you first and let you know about a position, which is you act as their advocate. You actually make a case for why they're a great candidate. Right? So you really paint the difference. I told you you could have them come up with 10 or 20 companies for you and even provide you the name of the hiring authority, or you can request that, and that you can also pay them a referral fee. And then lastly, we just talked about some of the documents, email messages, sales call reluctance, how to overcome that, and the actual formal veto letter, right? So, and then you can see what we covered over the last 2 days, some of the different things, how to diffuse the pressure of a sales call, the permission marketing script, how to overcome common objections, and then what we covered today as well. And in a moment, we're going to switch and see what we have in terms of Q&A. So first of all, I just want to thank you for joining me on this 2-day adventure. It's hopefully you have learned some things that you can put into practice. The biggest takeaway that I would say you want to think about is actually taking action on what you've learned today, putting something in your calendar that is an action item for you to work on either today or certainly by next week, right? Specifically, strategic alliances, who are the people that come to mind that I could contact, that I could have lunch with, that I could at least send an email? And I'll tell you one trick that I do for myself sometimes, if it's Friday and I'm leaving for the day and I'm unmotivated, let's say, and I've got a lot of work that I could do, but maybe I'm just not feeling it, I will try to create positive constraints for me for next week. So, for instance, let's say in my roundtable program, I do a certain amount of interviews per year, right? 12, a new interview comes out every month. If I get behind on that, I could record them myself, come up with content myself, or I can do interviews. So if it's Friday at 4 and I want to get out of here, I may just send out 5 or 6 emails to people that I want to interview, just saying, hey, I'd like to talk to you about doing an interview. What are your thoughts? So I've kind of kicked that ball across the field as I leave the door for the weekend, right? And you can do that as well. You could today send out an email, hey, I've got this great idea I'd love to talk to you about. Do you have some time next week? So you obligate yourself to follow through because of, you know, an email that you send today. So think about that as well. And Ariana, we're going to switch to Q&A if we've got questions.
Yes, we do have a few.
Okay. All right. So just fire away and we'll see how far we get here.
Okay. Mike in Green Bay asks, do you have an example of a formal agreement for strategic alliance?
The one that I have is actually copyrighted by another trainer. I'll tell you who they are, and you could contact them to get one. I can't share it because it is something that is copyrighted from them. But the company is Rice Cohen International. And I don't know if they're doing training these days or not. I believe the website is rciconsulting.com. That's where I got it personally. And but if you don't have a copy of something like that yourself, like I said, you could draw up something. Even if it's simple, it's fine. Even if it's a half a page, it's better than nothing. And what it should cover is what constitutes a referral, you know, what actually constitutes a referral. When are they paid? Meaning, are they paid when you get paid, which I don't advise, or are they paid after the guarantee, which I do advise, because it's going to be very hard to collect from them if there's a fall off. So those are the kinds of details you want to work out, but it doesn't need to be overly complicated. The one I have is overly complicated, I will tell you that, the one that I mentioned. It's about 5 pages long with a lot of tiny type. So I wouldn't really recommend it. I would come up with something very short and use that. What else, Ariana?
Okay, Kevin in Indianapolis. He asked three separate questions. The first question is two-part. So the first part, on day one, you discussed the frequency of calls and leaving voice messages. When using the options or permissions marketing scripts, in what situations do you send email messages and how do you word them?
Well, both of those are, they could be an email or a phone call, right? The way that they're structured in the version that you have that we went over yesterday, those are structured as phone calls. Those are structured as a conversation you're going to have. So if you wanted to send it as an email, you could do that, but you'd have to tweak it. You'd have to make it a little bit different. For instance, the permission marketing approach is way too long as it's written to make sense in an email. So if I were in your shoes and I wanted to use it in an email, I would use the email messages that I have included as a template for structure, meaning look at how short they are, look at how tiny the sentences are, look at how easy it is to say yes at the end, and use that template as a structure to create whatever email you might for those other two purposes. So, for instance, you might introduce the idea and then say, would it make sense to set up a 10-minute conversation to go over the details? Right? So, again, the purpose of that email is not to really sell everything. It's just to sell a phone appointment. And that's a key thing, kind of like yesterday when we talked about the pink spoon idea. You know, the pink spoon, when you offer that, it's not designed to sell an ice cream cone. It's designed to sell a pink spoon. Would you like to take a pink spoonful of ice cream? Yes. Okay, great. Now that you've done that, you're going to want the ice cream cone. So the email marketing message is just to get you to the appointment. All right. What else, Ariana?
Okay, the second part of that question is, on day one, you mentioned using an auto dialer. Which one do you use and or recommend?
Yeah, so the one I'm a little shy to say I recommend, but the one that I would say has the most positive reviews that I have heard is CallLogic. Okay, so I would look at CallLogic. If you want to look at other ones, you could just put in auto dialer or predictive dialer into Google, and you're going to get overwhelmed with a bunch. But CallLogic is one that works well for our industry and that I've heard good things about from multiple sources. What else, Ariana?
Okay, his next question is, does Adam Sloan send the general introduction email only for true referrals, or does he have a response to, quote, who gave me your name, end quote?
No, I don't think it has to be a referral at all. Let me see here. I had a conversation with someone who I see what you're saying. Yes. So the way that's written, that would be a true referral. If you don't have a true referral, you can either remove that sentence, or you can say, I had a conversation this morning which prompted me to reach out to you, right? So the way it's phrased right now is a conversation with someone who recommended that you and I connect. I would not put that if that's, first of all, if that's not true. If it is true, but you can't mention the name, then you could put that in there. And if they say, who is it, then you want to have an explanation for that, which we can talk about. I can give you an idea of what that would sound like. If it is true, but you can't use their name, that's okay. But if it's not true at all, don't say that, right? Because that's just lying out. So if you can't use their name, you can use this response, which I learned from Lefkowitz years ago. The person who referred your name may be currently working with me in a search process. And if I were to work with you, I would offer you the exact same confidentiality. Right? So the person that referred you may be working with me currently on a project. If you and I were to work together, I would offer you the same exact same confidentiality. Okay, and I've said that, a version of that, I don't know, hundreds of times, and it goes over very, very well if it's rehearsed and if you sound confident when you say it. Okay, so how you sound if you're saying that over the phone is going to make a big difference. What else, Arianna?
Okay, the last question is from Kevin again. And in the marketing a candidate email, there seems to be identifiable information. So the prospect could go around the recruiter. Shouldn't this be avoided?
Yes, for sure. So it's whatever level of information or detail you're able to provide without giving away the identity of the person, right? So if there's something here that would give them away, then you would want to remove that. You know, and that's a judgment call. You know your niche market. You know your candidate pool better than anyone. But the idea behind this is that it is a blinded presentation. That's really important. And that's just a judgment call on your end. You don't want to put anything that will allow them to identify a person. Is that it, Arianna?
Yep, that is the last question.
Okay. So we are about perfect on time, which is good. I like to try to end right around the set time. And like I said before, thank you for joining me. I know you have a lot of options when it comes to training, and I hope you got value from this presentation. If you did or if you didn't, either way, you want to give me some feedback, I would always be open and appreciative of that. You can email me directly at gary@therecruitinglab.com. And again, if you want to try out the roundtable for 30 days at no charge, just go to the handouts page and you'll get all the details. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.